The Orientation. As I turned the rental car onto Maury Street in West Newton, a quiet suburb of Boston, I had a cup of coffee in one hand and a cellular phone between my ear and shoulder. I was talking to a TV producer about a piece we were doing. My eyes jumped from the digital clock to the mailbox numbers on the tree-lined suburban street. The car radio was on, blasting the all-news station. This was how I operated, five things at once. "Roll back that tape," I said to the producer. "Let me hear that part again." "Okay," he said. "It's going to take a second." Suddenly, I was upon the house. I pushed the brakes, spilling coffee on my lap. As the car stopped, I caught a glimpse of a large Japanese maple tree and three figures sitting near it in the driveway, a young man and a middle-aged woman flanking a small old man in a wheelchair. Maury. At the sight of my old professor, I froze. "Hello," the producer said in my ear. "Did I lose you?" I had not seen Maury in 16 years. His hair was thinner, nearly white, and his face was gaunt. I suddenly felt unprepared for this reunion. For one thing, I was stuck on the phone, and I hoped that he hadn't noticed my arrival, so that maybe I could drive around the block a few more times, finish my business, get mentally ready. But Maury, this new withered version of a man I had once known so well, was smiling at the car, hands folded in his lap, waiting for me to emerge. "Hey," the producer said again, "are you there?" For all the time we'd spent together, for all the kindness and patience Maury had shown me when I was young, I should have dropped the phone and jumped from the car, run and held him and kissed him hello. Instead, I killed the engine and sunk down off the seat, as if I were looking for something. Yeah, I'm here," I whispered, and continued my conversation with the TV producer until we were finished. I did what I had become best at doing. I tended to my work, even while my dying professor waited on his front lawn. I'm not proud of this, but that is what I did. Now, 5 minutes later, Maury was hugging me, his thinning hair rubbing against my cheek. I told him I was searching for my keys, that's what had taken me so long in the car, and I squeezed him tighter as if I could crush my little lie. Although the spring sunshine was warm, he wore a windbreaker and his legs were covered by a blanket. He smelled faintly sour, the way people on medication sometimes do. With his face pressed close to mine, I could hear his labored breathing in my ear. "My old friend," he whispered, "you've come back at last." He rocked against me, not letting go, his hands reaching up for my elbows as I bent over him. I was surprised at such affection after all these years, but then, in the stone walls I had built between my present and my past, I had forgotten how close we once were. I remembered graduation day, that briefcase, his tears at my departure, and I swallowed because I knew deep down that I was no longer the good, gift-bearing student he remembered. I only hoped that for the next few hours I could fool him. Inside the home, we sat at a walnut dining room table near a window that looked out on the neighbor's house. Maury fussed with his wheelchair, trying to get comfortable. As was his custom, he wanted to feed me, and I said, "All right." One of the helpers, a stout Italian woman named Connie, cut up bread and tomatoes and brought containers of chicken salad, hummus, and tabbouleh. She also bought some pills. Maury looked at them and sighed. His eyes were more sunken than I remembered them, and his cheekbones more pronounced. This gave him a harsher, older look. Until he smiled, of course, and the sagging cheeks gathered up like curtains. "Mitch," he said softly, "you know that I'm dying." "I knew," I said. "All right then," Maury said, swallowing the pills. He put down the paper cup, inhaled deeply, then let it out. "Shall I tell you what it's like?" "What it's like," I said, "to die?" "Yes," he said. Although I was unaware of it, our last class had just begun. It is my freshman year of college. Maury's older than most of the teachers, and I'm younger than most of the students, having left high school a year early. To compensate for my youth on campus, I wear old gray sweatshirts and box in a local gym, and walk around with an unlit cigarette in my mouth, even though I don't smoke. I drive a beat-up Mercury Cougar with the windows down and the music up. I seek my identity in toughness, but it is Maury's softness that draws me. And because he does not look at me as a kid trying to be something more than I am, I relax. I finish that first course with him and enroll for another. He's an easy marker, doesn't much care for grades. One year, they say, during the Vietnam War, Maury gave all his male students A's just to help them keep their student deferments. I begin to call Maury Coach, the way I used to address my high school track coach. Maury likes the nickname. "Coach," he says. "All right, I'll be your coach, and you can be my player. You can play all the lovely parts of life that I'm too old for now. Sometimes Maury and I eat together in the cafeteria. To my delight, Maury's even more of a slob than I am. He talks instead of chewing, laughs with his mouth open, delivers a passionate thought through a mouthful of egg salad, the little yellow pieces spewing from his teeth. It cracks me up. The whole time I know him, I have two overwhelming desires: to hug him and to give him a napkin.